How's it going, everybody? My name is John Steyert, and this is episode 25 of Social Echoes from True Voice Media, the True Voice Media podcast. I'm very excited because on the other side of the podcast today is a very interesting guy. His name is Matt Wallert, and he's joining me from San Francisco, California. How you doing today, Matt?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. So, Matt, amongst many other things that you'd probably describe yourself in your Twitter profile, you have yourself listed as a behavioral scientist for Bing, and you are a co-founder for Get Raised. So I would imagine that Bing and Microsoft take up the majority of your time.
It does. So Get Raised is a great side project left over from one of my previous companies. And it's something that we love doing. It's a great volunteer effort. But my main gig and where I spend the majority of my time is at Microsoft.
So Microsoft is obviously such a polarizing thing right now. and I say that kind of, you know, obviously with all due respect. And it's probably a really fascinating time in the company right now because there was just the Xbox One release. You have the...
Right.
Facebook Graph Search being released, which is powered by Bing. And I'm sure you probably have a very deep knowledge of that, and I want to get into that. You have the Windows Phone and the Surface Tablet. So lots of stuff going on at Microsoft.
And, of course, now we're powering iOS, right? It's just been announced that we're powering Siri. So really there's only two games in town, given that we power Yahoo's Search and Facebook's Search and now iOS's Search. I think that... it's really us and Google who, you know, have the resources to really take on this very difficult problem.
So what's that like? I mean, you get to kind of be, it's like that love triangle between Microsoft, Google, and Apple. Obviously, Microsoft and Apple kind of have this love-hate relationship at times, different points. Everybody always remembers the gigantic floating head of Bill Gates behind Steve Jobs in 1997, and kind of how Microsoft dipped down a little bit and Apple shot up in the next 10 years with the iPhone release and everything in between. And it's funny because I was just at Google New York on Monday, and having not been to any of Microsoft's offices, I can't really compare. But so what's it like being kind of in the middle of all that?
I mean, I think let me sort of separate those into two questions. First, the sort of Microsoft, Apple, love-hate relationship. You know, it's interesting, right, in that we have two founders who really, I think, had a deep love and respect for each other. You know, they visited as Steve Jobs was sick and dying. You know, there's some great interviews between the two of them, and you don't see a lot of animosity. You know, I think people forget tech loves a scandal, right? Tech loves to pair people against each other, right? But, you know, Microsoft Office on Apple products, you know, we were the productivity suite for Apple for a very, very long time. It was a fantastically profitable business for us, you know, and it was a great thing to be able to sort of power the productivity of the world. And the great thing about, like, buying a shocking number of people dual boot into Windows on a Macintosh computer or have Windows installed on a Macintosh computer, and, you know, Apple could easily have made it so that you couldn't do that, or have fought harder against it, but they made that an attractive feature of their computers that you could dual boot, right? And they enabled boot camp and other things. So I think we've really had a closer relationship with them over time than I think sometimes the media likes to remember. That said, you know, certainly the companies are in business to make money, and they want to do that to the best of their ability, and sometimes that means competing. But I think it's a fairly friendly competition. With Google, you know, I think that is at times also a very friendly competition, although I think we may just – part of the difference there may be about alignment of values. I'm not sure that Microsoft and Google really have the same value system at some core place, both in terms of where they see technology going, where they see the future of technology and the future of privacy and the future of some other things. And I think we have a deep and healthy respect for them. I mean, I have tons of friends at Google. You know, I lots of people on an individual basis, I think they do some really great things. But I think we just have a fundamentally different view of where the internet may be going. And maybe that's not true. I mean, maybe what happens is we all converge over time. And really, I think all three companies believe in a genuine, like, not cynical way that they are working on trying to make the world a better place. and they may have different versions of how they do that and what that looks like and how they fund that. You know, Microsoft, I think, believes more strongly in a sort of traditional business model where we provide value to people and then they pay us for that in the form of like an Xbox One, for example, right? If you want, you know, whatever it is that you are trying to do, you can go to Microsoft and we'll sell you a product to do the Xbox. You know, you can pay us for Xbox One, you can pay us for an operating system, you can pay us for a productivity suite, and I think that's the reason that we're in so many businesses, right? We really power not just American businesses, but, you know, around the world, the majority of businesses run Microsoft products for, I think, a good reason. And I think that's really different than a company that makes 95% of its revenue on advertising. I mean, Google is not a tech company. They're an advertising company. And that, I think, is a really different philosophical place from which to start thinking about the future. Now, there's been signs that Google's moving away from that model, right? Pushing Google Apps, you know, trying to move into Chromebooks and onto devices. You know, I think that it may be that they are moving away from that. And, of course, Bing is ad-supported. So there are parts in which, you know, they're Microsoft's only revenue is not just from direct sales. So I think that, you know, it may be where we end up as a future is we all sort of come to an agreement about what the future of technology business models should look like. How's that for a long-winded answer to a short question?
No, that's a great question because I think you, like you said, you broke it into two questions, which is really what it was. It was just me kind of trying to get everything out in one shot, and sometimes it's not always the best thing. But so let's talk about Bing, which is where you spend the majority of your time, as you've already noted. Obviously, if you turn on the TV and you're watching, so let's say people are watching the NBA Finals for Game 7 in a couple nights, and they see the Bing commercials featuring Jonah Ray from the Nerdist podcast, and they're saying he goes to Topeka, Kansas, which was once Google, Kansas, and he's talking about how people prefer Bing to Google, I don't know, what is it, 2-to-1 or something? And it's fascinating because it's really cool that I get to talk to you right now because my grandfather is a Microsoft guy, has been for a long time, but he has an iPad, he's got an iPhone, blah, blah, blah. Not that that takes away from him being now a Bing guy, but he was ringing up different things as to why Bing is better, and me just being a Google guy simply because it's there. I haven't really had any necessary reason to switch over, but now the seed of, you know, curiosity has been planted in my head, and obviously now I'm talking to you, so I'll be more inclined to try it.
Well, we appreciate that.
Well, I'm sure you do. So is there any like specific thing that Bing does better than Google?
Well, let me answer that question in a roundabout way. I want to start with some of the earlier stuff you said. You know, I think Bing it on as a scientist, right? Someone who comes from a psych background and a lab science background. I love Bing it on because you now can go and test what works for you. And I absolutely encourage people to go and take the challenge and use the search engine that works for them, right? The greatest possible thing that you can do is strip the branding off something, look at the core functionality of it, and be able to test how it works for you. And it now that turns out when you do that, that yes, about 2-to-1 people prefer us, especially for the top queries, right? If you take Google's top queries, you know, things people searched most in 2012, we did this great study, things people searched most in 2012, took the branding off, had people do those searches, and it turned out 2-to-1 they preferred, you know, Bing. That's a pretty strong statement, right? And I think that it's I think not just in Google versus Bing, but I wish more products had this. I wish I could compare more things for myself, you know, so because what a great way to be able to find the product that really works best for you.
Totally.
You know, for your grandfather, you know, I think it's good that he owns iDevices, and I think that it's good that there's an ecosystem of devices out there that spur us into better competition and really push us to push the envelope. You know, I think one thing that's really important to Bing is all of our partnerships, right? We work with Facebook. We power Yahoo Search. I think, you know, a little bit different than a Google who wants Google Plus to be the social network of choice and all of the other things. You know, I think we're more interested in there being a healthy ecosystem that we can work with and build with. So I think it's – I want there to be a selection of services for your grandfather to use and for you to use. You know, what makes Bing different? You know, obviously there's the relevance and quality aspect. I think that, you know, one place where you can see a really clear difference is in image search. So I think this was pointed out to me by an engineer from the image team the other day who was just sort of like, I have to say I don't use image search a ton, and so it wasn't something I had a bunch of experience with. And he was like, look, just pull up two browsers side by side. Like, pull up Chrome and use Google, and pull up, you know, Internet Explorer and use Bing, and just enter the same queries into both, and you'll see just how much better we are at visual search. And I really was pretty amazed. I mean, one of the things that happens is we're because we actually analyze the picture itself, not the words around it, which is, I understand, is the way Google is doing it, you really can see some very stark differences. And one of those, for example, is like deduping, right? So if you use Google image search, you'll see a lot of the same image, right? Particularly for iconic searches. Like if you search for like a Batman movie, you know, you'll get the same movie poster and over because it can't figure out that they're actually the same picture. Where because we're doing actual pixel analysis, like there's very little duping because we can figure out like, oh, those are actually the same picture. We only need to show one of them. So it's actually really, really fascinating to watch things like that evolve. But I mean, I think the real answer is that the core differentiators are going to end up are not the things that are public today, they're the things that will be public going forward and the direction that we take going forward. I mean, I think Bing's real emphasis right now is on Bing becoming more of the, you know, sort of pipes on which other experiences are built, right? So if you look at like GeoFlow in Excel, right, the ability to take data and as long as it has location data in it, to put it on a 3D map that you can explore, you can mash up with other data. I mean, that kind of pushing out of Bing search into other places, I think, is really key and really important. I mean, if you've seen the previews of Windows 8.1, right, that comes out at the end of the summer and in the fall, I think it's true. You know, people, I understand the critiques of Windows 8. It's hard to move to a new operating system and a new experience, particularly if you're not using touch, which is where Windows 8 really shines. But one of the ways it's really changed the way that I use my computer is I never actually click on the icon of anything ever. I just hit the Windows key and start typing the name of it and then hit enter and it finds it and opens it up. So I don't click on Outlook anymore. I just hit the Windows key, start typing Outlook, hit enter, and up it comes. And now with Windows 8.1, it'll actually be able to do search results from Bing as well. So I can hit the Windows key, type, you know, who is, you know, John Steiner, and get real comprehensible results without ever opening a search engine, right? Just straight in the operating system. And that's really, I think, the sort of core future technology that I think is going to differentiate Bing from the Googles of the world. It's going to be saying, look, we can have a one computer experience in which, whether it's files or programs or apps or things in the cloud or web search results, we're going to be able to understand what it is you want, that intent piece, and then match it up with where that is. Because I think that's how you sort of push technology forward, right? When we start thinking about, Google loves to talk about the Star Trek computer, right, and how they want to build the Star Trek computer. The closest thing to the Star Trek computer, to me, feels like when I hit that Windows key, and I often have voice turned on, if I hit that Windows key and look and Outlook opens up, I mean, it's hard to argue with that experience as you're having it. And we're a long way from Gene Roddenberry's vision, a long way from really being able to sort of show that off, but we're also a lot closer than we were 10 years ago.
It's really cool that you can that Bing focuses on the image search in such a different way with the pixels, and it's the first I've heard of that, so I will definitely be checking that out, simply because, I mean, in my world of social, visual obviously is such powerful impact, because just naturally, and you would know this as you said, your background is in psychology. You know, the human eye and the brain translates visual like 60,000 times faster than anything else. So that information is absorbed instantaneously, nearly, when compared to text. So let me ask you about your background then, as I just alluded to, and as you said in the answer before. So you come from a psychology background?
I do. I never really thought of myself as a technologist. I mean, so I grew up in a very blue-collar, rural Oregon family. And my parents, I think, saw the power of computers early on. So we got a computer relatively early on for Christmas. But it's not like we had the money to, like, have somebody fix it, right? If we broke it, like, we fixed it. And so I spent my youth sort of tinkering with computers and mainly because I had broken them. And you know, I continued in college. You know, that was always sort of my part-time job, was always like working with a computing desk or whatever. I sort of worked my way through college. But I was always in college and in grad school in love with something we call JDM, judgment and decision making. So it's a branch of psychology that looks at some of the underlying principles to how people actually think and act in the world in general. So it's not about abnormal psychology. It's about how you and I and everybody else goes into a restaurant and looks at a menu and makes a decision. And
how psychology.
Exactly. And how if that menu was different, or the restaurant was different, or we were with different people, or if someone else, I mean, there's a great study that looks at how, you know, if someone else ordered the dish that you plan to order, you'll change your order, right? You, like, in a small group, people will not have the same dish, even though it's the thing that they prior to another person ordering it, it was the thing that they wanted. And so things like that were just fascinating to me. And so that's what I was really working on. And then I got, you know, sort of pulled out of grad school into a startup that was doing, trying to change financial behaviors, and then sold that. And you know, from there sort of went off this entrepreneurship route that has landed me eventually at Bing, where I'm very, very happy to be.
So one thing that I'm always curious about with behavior, and I know that in marketing psychology, in today's social business world, one of the guys that's doing it exceptionally well is Derek Halpern of socialtriggers.com. Sure. But one of the questions that I'm always curious about, and I always kind of think about when I'm, you know, just on a run or just in the office doing whatever, what influences behavior? And I always think it's probably more so attitude than anything else. So would you agree with that, or do you have maybe another stance on it?
So I think it's very difficult to know in general, to say in a general blanket way, this is the thing that really defines behavior. But the thing that we have the most effect over, or the thing that is easiest for us to change that has a huge effect on behavior, is environment, right? The environment in which people are thinking and acting. You talked about being out for a run and thinking about psychology, right? The factors that determine how far you run are often very external to you, right? There's certainly something, you know, you have your internal drive to be running, but if your shoes don't fit, or the day's too hot, or like, trying to run you over, like these other forces will really, really constrain and bind what you do that day, often in very, very non-conscious ways, right? In ways that we're not even aware of. And so I think that is a prime place for people who are trying to change behavior to look to, because it's very, very hard. I can't reach inside your brain and change your attitude, right? That's very, very difficult. And particularly not without like a lot of, I mean, brand advertising, where we try and get you to think a particular thing about a brand, you know, requires a lot of exposure and a lot of money, and you're fighting with other attentional factors and things. But if you can really get to the environment in which someone's making a decision, I think that's the place where, particularly from a public good perspective, we can do the most. You know, in some ways, when you look at the really, really successful companies that I think are really doing innovative things, they're changing that environment. I mean, look at somebody like Uber, right? You know, which I think is a great company. They really, I think, took a good hard look at what the environment of and the experience of taking a cab was like, and said, how can we change the choice environment to make this easier? It is incredibly easy to get an Uber, right? You're not paying on the spot. I mean, it has this very flowy feeling that is really coming from the environment. It's not us. Like, they could have spent the same amount of money trying to say, like, Uber, use it because it's awesome, right? But I think that, you know, by and large, the majority of where we can push human civilization forward is in those environmental changes that allow us to make different kinds of decisions.
So do you think that environment has a big impact on your job and what environment does for search?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Environment is a huge cue to intent for us, right? Being able to look at the environment in which someone is, you know, whether it's location or time or previous searches, right? Things that they just searched for, or search history, you know, those are huge cues for us about what it is you're trying to do. And I think that,
I would imagine, you know, great, mobile probably has a big factor in that, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, mobile, because of all of the sensors that get incorporated into that. Although even without mobile, there are some really like commonplace things that we can do that are actually really powerful and fairly easy. I mean, let me put that differently. They're not easy, they're simple, right? They're not complex, they are very hard to do, but they're not complex. But things like Java, right? If you search for Java, are you looking for coffee or a programming language, right? And so we can say, well, did he just search for a programming language? Like if he just said Perl and then he said Java, we're like, ah, he's probably looking for the programming language, right? Whereas if you just said like, you know, Sumatra and or like cream or like percolator, right? We can go, oh, he's probably looking for coffee. Or, hey, you just looked at travel and you're talking about Java the country and you want to like go to Java and meet Javanese people. I mean, that kind of, I think there's a really just tons and tons of environmentally rich data that we can use. And the right way to think about search is to think about human beings, right? You are using context all the time in this conversation, right? Whether it's your visual system that fills in blind spots and interprets things that I'm doing and looks at my facial features to indicate, like, are these hand movements friendly or aggressive, right? Tone of voice, words. Like, I can say things that you will actively reinterpret without ever even thinking about it, you know, in a conscious way. Oh, I think he said this, right? He slurred a little, but this makes sense in the sentence, and so I'm going to fill that in. Search has that same sort of problem. It's saying, how can we do exactly what humans do, which is take the environment and use it to allow people not to have to be incredibly specific in their communication, right? Because we're really quite general in our communication. When we talk to each other, we make many, many assumptions about, you know, what you're going to understand, what I'm going to understand, and I don't have to continually reiterate every single point. You know, when I talk about Bing, I'm talking, imagine we had this interview, and every time I said Bing, I had to say, Bing, the search engine owned by Microsoft, and not the sound, and not the cherry, and not, like, you know, all of these other possible things. That would just be overwhelming. But in many ways, that's where search started, right? Few people remember this, but sort of originally search was just not very, like, Google was just not very good 10 years ago. You could never have said, like, who is Matt Wallert? You had to say, like, Matt Wallert, Microsoft, Bing, Seattle psychologist. And then maybe you got something. But now, in a modern search engine, you can go to something like Bing and say, who is Matt Wallert, and get really comprehensible, rich results with a picture, with where I went to school, with what I do now, with, you know, not just 10 blue links, but a really rich idea of, like, this context of who is Matt Wallert. And there may be another Matt Wallert out there in the world, and we can look at the environment in which you made that search to sort of say, oh, yeah, in the same way that, like, our conversation, we know Bing means Bing the search engine, I know Matt Wallert meant this Matt Wallert and not that Matt Wallert.
The science behind all this is always so intriguing to me, and I do not have a science background by experience or anything, but when I was 12 years old, I wanted to be a medical doctor, and I've always kind of kept that fascination of science, even though I was not academically good at the sciences and math. I think that I've actually become more scientifically inclined as I've gotten a little bit older, and it's really, really great to have conversations like that, just to hear explanations like you've been giving.
Well, I mean, everybody I ever talk to always says, like, hey, if I was gonna get a second degree, it would be in psychology, you know. And in many ways, that's not surprising, right? We human beings, by definition, interact with other human beings. It's the one thing that we are really well programmed genetically and evolutionarily to do, is to interact in groups with other human beings. And it's really what sets us apart, right? Is this civilization has allowed us to sort of claw our way out of the morass of living hand to mouth. And I think that psychology just has such an interesting role to play in that. And so many of the things we think we know now, I'm sure will be proved wrong. I mean, it's really a fledgling science in so many ways. And I love people are armchair psychologists and have these theories and test these theories, because it means that all of us are thinking about this very essential human trait. And it's great when people have a chance to interact with that science. No diss on physics or chemistry or biology.
No.
You should take those sciences too. But psychology, you know, we're
Psychology, it's tops.
Yeah, it's tops. I mean, I love my job in that I get to, you know, I had a breakfast with someone this morning who was sort of like, I never see psychologists in technology, how weird. And I was like, but that's what's so great about it, right? Psychologists have a role to play in almost every industry. You know, there is unrealized potential that psychology can go and try and realize.
So let's talk about your other job, which is you're the co-founder of Get Raised.
Yes.
So can you walk me through what Get Raised does?
Sure. So Get Raised is a completely free tool that we built to help people, particularly women and minorities, understand if they're underpaid and then do something about it. And it's completely free, and it's sort of broken into three sections. So you come in and you tell us what you do, where you work, and how much you make, and we'll tell you, using a mashup of government data and our own data, whether you're underpaid. You know, we can sort of say, you're here, everyone else is here, you really need to ask for a raise. And then we actually can ask you a few more very simple questions that actually generates a letter that you can give to your boss asking for a raise. So it lays out very clearly, this is market rate, here are open jobs in our area, like that establish these points about like sort of what I should be compensated at. Here's what I've done, here's what I'm going to do, here's how I'm adding value to the organization. And you can hand in this letter, schedule a meeting, and then we give you some, start walking through the process. All right, here's some things to think about, you know, before you have this raise meeting. And then we also are kind of nudging you. Did you schedule it? Did you go? Because it's that follow-through piece that's really important. And we've been very lucky to have tremendous success. You know, 70% of the women that use it do get a raise. The average raise is about $7,000, which for a free tool is just amazing. We're very fortunate. Recently, Sheryl Sandberg and Lean In endorsed us, and so we've been working with them a lot. And it's just a side passion project that really came from, you know, that first startup as I got pulled out of grad school and we started working on financial behaviors. You know, the way that we didn't want to just – we had a financial health score that was about your behaviors. We didn't want to just be like, hey, rich people get a high score, poor people get a low score. –